Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the President's vow to fix the website launching the Affordable Care Act and assess the damage to the already battered initiative known as Obamacare that has been under relentless assault since it narrowly passed into law. Kevin Lucia, Research Professor and Project Director at Georgetown University's Health Policy Initiative, joins us to discuss how much the technical glitches are impeding enrollment in the new health insurance exchanges. Then we'll hear from a physician, Dr. Philip Caper, who is a founding board member of Maine's AllCare, a nonpartisan, nonprofit group committed to making healthcare in Maine universal, accessible, and affordable for all. We will explore his contention that the Affordable Care Act is far too complicated and that the choice people really want is a choice of healthcare providers, not insurers, and discuss his article, The High Costs of Complexity in Healthcare Reform. Then finally, we will speak with former Assistant Secretary of Education Diane Ravitch about her new book, Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. We'll discuss the destructive innovation pushed by billionaires and Wall Street hedge fund managers who are leading the charge to defund public education in the name of reform while propagating myths about miracle charter schools and claims that public education is broken and beyond repair. And joining us now is Kevin Lucia, who is a research professor and project director at Georgetown University's Health Policy Initiative, where his current research focuses on federal and state implementation of the Affordable Care Act. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kevin Lucia.
Thanks for having me.
And clearly, the Affordable Care Act, the launch of it is troubled. And the president said today there's no sugarcoating it. The website has been too slow. People have been getting stuck during the application process, and nobody's more frustrated than I am. And I must say, after the president survived the attacks from the Congress trying to defund Obamacare and in the process shutting down the government and threatening to default on the debt, this seems like the last thing he needs.
Yeah, I think that's a fair thing to say. And he did say, no one is madder than me that the website isn't working, which means it's going to get fixed. And I think that's really important. You know, with all these large IT build-outs, there's always going to be glitches. And the most important thing is that there's people on the ground identifying what the glitches are and figuring out a plan to improve them. So healthcare.gov has had problems, which I think the administration acknowledged today completely. And it sounds like they have, you know, a plan in place to start the corrective action that needs to get done over the next couple of weeks. I would say that the state-based exchanges, you know, where the states are actually running the exchanges, such as in California and Washington, D.C. and Maryland, those the IT issues have been less significant, and again, the state-based exchanges, when they have surfaced, have you know set up plans to fix them or are in the process of improving them. But it was an interesting call today with the president, for sure.
But it seems since the Affordable Care Act was first launched, and obviously it was a real cliffhanger in getting it passed, and then it was a cliffhanger in getting the Supreme Court to uphold it, and all the while the opponents have been very vocal, very well-financed, and they seem to be having more traction than those defending it. I don't think anybody can argue, surely, that the administration's done a great job in selling this. And are we at a point, I mean, could it be a point of criticality here that given the negativity so far, are we going to get past that point? Because you would think that the launching of this Affordable Care Act and the starting of these exchanges would have been the moment where things turned around.
I think that there are so many benefits to this law, and I think, well, first of all, let's just back up. I think the president made it clear today that they're going to fix the website. And you got to look beyond the website and think about the fundamentals of the law, which are really important, especially in the individual and small group market. And that's, you know, today, in today's individual market, individuals can be discriminated based on their health status. They can be discriminated based on their gender. The policies that they offer don't necessarily cover what they really need, such as, you know, maternity benefits. They're now being required to, they can be rated up based on their health status. So they're charged more based on their age, their health status, their gender. So, you know, the ACA basically puts an end to that discrimination. people, you know, will be able to go to this website. And granted, the healthcare.gov is having some problems, but once this is up and clear, and in many states it's already happening right now, people are able to shop and compare and purchase, you know, coverage. And that's really important. They're not discriminated based on their health status. They're not discriminated based on their gender. They're able to get an essential help, you know, a package of essential benefits that covers doctor's visits and prescription drugs and preventive care without cost sharing. I mean, I think these are really important. So we've seen a fundamental change of the individual market. And it's to the benefit of consumers, and I think that's really what the president was saying. Like, you got to look beyond the website, look at the fundamentals of the law, and I think that's right.
But it would seem, though, that everything you've told us, while true, it's not well known. Isn't that the problem? That those that have been demagoguing and misrepresenting it, and you know, even you've got the Koch brothers, for example, funding a group of young people called Generation Opportunity.
Yeah, I think you're right, Ian. There's been challenges in many of the states to get out the message of what is of value to the consumers with this healthcare bill, and I think that this is something that the administration is going to have to double back on and really get out the message more on why this is important for consumers.
But isn't that at the heart of whether or not it will work, that you need a big pool and you need young, healthy people, in effect, to subsidize those that need health care?
Right. And as I was saying, at the state-based level, so the state-based exchanges have been doing a fantastic job with the consumer outreach. And I would say also that the administration has been, you know, working hard to get out the message about the bill. And it started later this summer, or, you know, and it was probably a result of that marketing burst that really allowed us to see significant numbers that were visiting healthcare.gov. Someone was just telling me that they're getting about 1 million people a day looking at healthcare.gov. That's impressive.
Again, I'm speaking with Kevin Lucia, who's a research professor and project director at Georgetown University's Health Policy Initiative, where his current research focuses on federal and state implementation of the Affordable Care Act. So is there any explanation for why, given that we were all expecting the launch in October of the exchanges and then everything is supposed to be ready in January for the full implementation, and is there any identifiable problem here? You would have thought that the administration knows that they've been under attack forever and that if anything goes wrong, the critics will be all over it. I mean, and I guess the good news is that the critics of the Affordable Care Act and those that shut down the government and threatened the full faith and credit of the United States in order to get their way, they've been discredited. So to your mind, is there a systemic problem here? Is the same group of people who have not been able to get this thing up and running, are they the right people to fix it? I mean, what's your...
I do. Look, I think that you have to think that this this is a transformation of the marketplace in the U.S., and there was a significant amount of background work that had to be done regarding, you know, the issuing of regs to kind of define this new framework that we're, you know, going into starting in January 1st. And I think that, yes, healthcare.gov, which is, you know, the feds, which is running, you know, the exchanges in 33 states, has had some challenges. But again, as I was saying before, I think it's really important that they became clear to me today that they have a process in place to identify all of their, you know, problems on healthcare.gov, and it seems to me that the entire administration is behind quickly fixing it. I would say the state-based exchanges, that's where the states are running the exchanges, have been successful at turning the lights on, and in many of those states, there's a smooth operation taking place. That's true in California, in D.C., and many of the other 17 states that are running their own health insurance exchanges.
Well, I think, though, Kevin Lucia, though, isn't it fair to say that uncertainty is the enemy here, that given so much negative propaganda over the last couple of years and all of the brinkmanship that we've just seen in Washington, that uncertainty is the enemy, right?
Well, it's true, but we do have some time. There is time on the side of the administration to get ahead of this. First of all, it's just the beginning of open enrollment, which is going to, you know, expand for 6 months. And so, you know, I think the thought has always been that most of the buying will start in December. And so, you know, you launch the exchange, so, you know, in November people are looking. In December, you know, they go in for the buy. And I think that, you know, to your point, the closer you get to the end of December, and if there are still significant problems, then, you know, then I think that more questions have to be answered. Not about the fundamental of the law, but just, you know, how the timing works with open enrollment and the start of the reforms in January.
So the Republicans, of course, the Republican-led House, they're scheduled hearings already for Thursday, and they've asked the head of Health and Human Services, Secretary Kathleen Sebelius, to attend. Apparently, she's not going to testify. Is she under fire? Is this going to be one of those things where they need a sacrificial lamb?
Well, hold on. I think that I think that's right that she turned down the invitation on Thursday. But I was reading something early today that she plans to visit the Hill after all on an agreeable date as early as next week. Mm-hmm. So you know, I think you know, I'm not privy to you know the scheduling of the secretary, but I think that you know it's important for her to be part of this conversation on the Hill, and it seems like that's what she's going to do.
Well, but to the other question, Kevin Lucian, is she secure? Or, I mean, is this, in other words, do they need a scapegoat, or they just feel that that they can tell the public to kind of with confidence that this is all going to work out and just be a little patient? I mean,
look, I think that's clearly what the president was saying today, is that we have identified the problems. We are identifying the team to fix them, and we're going to do that. I mean, I don't, you know, and I think that even as, you know, as late as last Friday, the administration had come out full support of the secretary. So I, you know, and that's not exactly, that this isn't my field of study, but I would say for sure, you know, at least the president's discussion today clearly made out that they feel that they have identified the problems, they're identifying the people to fix it, and he's asking for some patience as they move forward.
So the fact that Nancy Pelosi was saying that the situation's unacceptable on Sunday, you don't think that even within his own ranks amongst the Democrats there's some nervousness here?
Yeah, I haven't studied what people have been saying today, so for the most part. But I think that the president agrees exactly with what Nancy Pelosi was saying over the weekend, that it's unacceptable the way that the website is working. But again, it's the website. It's a very important piece of the shopping experience. But, you know, the fundamentals of the bill is still in place. I think that at the end of the day, the IT problems will be fixed out. They're probably going to take a little bit more time than initially thought. But in all large IT buildouts, you know, this is both private and public. There's problems, and they come to be that they're fixed. And I would say, like, if you look at Medicare Part D, which was rolled out, there were glitches to begin with, and over time they were fixed, and now it's an extremely popular program that's available for Medicare recipients to get their pharmaceutical benefits.
Just in closing, Kevin Lucia, obviously this whole thing depends upon the bigger the pool, the lower the costs. And
yep.
Are you confident that when this is launched and the dust settles, that the costs will be lowered? Because if they're not, I think that the administration is going to have an awfully hard time.
Oh, well, I think that, you know, at least some of the work that we've already done looking at the premiums that are coming out on exchanges, I think that they're more reasonable than we initially thought. So already there are signs that in states that have robust participants within their exchange as far as issuers, that there is signs of competition. And that competition will only get more robust as we go on year to year.
Well, Kevin Lucia, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Kevin Lucia, who's a research professor and project director at Georgetown University's Health Policy Initiative, where his current research focuses on federal and state implementation of the Affordable Care Act. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the choices people want, which are healthcare providers, not insurers.
And so no one would know how tired they've grown of talking and telling their lies. All we've got, no health insurance, no cellular service, no disease they can cure. But we need more money to burn, so each person must learn the dollar amount they are worth. And those pills make me...
Doctor, my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of without crying. Now I want to understand. I have done all that I could to see the evil and the good without hiding. You must help me if you can.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Philip Caper, who is a physician in Portland, Maine, and a regular columnist at the Bangor Daily News, where he recently wrote a piece, The High Cost of Complexity in Healthcare Reform. And he's also a founding board member of Maine All Care, a nonpartisan, nonprofit group committed to making healthcare in Maine universal, accessible, and affordable for all. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Philip Caper.
Thank you.
And obviously the president is on the defensive, and it seems like it's the last thing he needs after the bruising battle with the Republicans who've been trying to defund and kill Obamacare. It does look like a self-inflicted wound here. What's your sense of how the president basically tried to apologize for the screw-ups with the launching of Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act?
Well, first of all, let me say I have tremendous admiration for the intent of this law and for the president's willingness to take on this very toxic political issue. And you can see that it's caused everybody lots of headaches so far, and it's hardly gotten going. Having said that, I think the problem with the enrollment in the marketplaces, as they call them, the exchanges, is really a result of the complexity of this law. It's an enormously complex piece of legislation. And I think that nobody could have launched this in a smooth way. So in a way, I don't blame them for having problems with the enrollment process. However, I do think that the law could have been a lot simpler. When Medicare, you know, I was a first-year resident at Boston City Hospital when Medicare was enacted. And Medicare enrolled 19 million people with very little trouble, despite a lot of intense political opposition from the southern hospitals who did not like Medicare's desegregation requirements. So I think much of the problems they're having are an inevitable result of the unnecessary complexity of the Affordable Care Act.
Well, of course, the problems initially that you know, probably discouraging people and certainly are inviting the press to be very skeptical about the Affordable Care Act in general is because the website's not working. That seems to be the initial problem, and that seems to be more of a technical problem than a policy problem or a problem vis-a-vis the complexity of the law.
Well, I actually don't agree. I think that some of the problem with the websites has to do with a number of different agencies that information has to be collected from in order to determine eligibility for the subsidies and eligibility for the different aspects of the program. There's just too much slicing and dicing of people. Now, in Medicare, for example, it doesn't matter what your income income is. It doesn't matter what your occupation is or was. Your disease history has no bearing on it. You're simply all in the same risk pool. And the Affordable Care Act, on the contrary, follows the insurance principle to its logical conclusion, and that is the business of slicing and dicing people into risk pools. That, I think, is the fundamental flaw of the Affordable Care Act.
Well, of course, a lot of people at the time felt that there should be a public option, and obviously most of the other advanced democracies have single-payer systems of one form or another.
Right.
And while it's a correct argument, it's a somewhat futile argument, isn't it?
It is futile as long as people are discouraged from discussing single-payer as a viable alternative. When I talk to people about single-payer, I get the reaction, quite frankly, that you've just given me. It's a good idea, but it can't be done. I mean, it certainly can't be done if we're not allowed to talk about it. And I must say I'm delighted you're covering this aspect of this story, because I think people in this country have to understand that in other wealthy democracies, when people get sick, they don't even think about the money. They just get the care that they need or their physicians recommend, and they don't think about the money. And Americans have trouble wrapping their minds around that concept. They don't believe it can exist, but it can exist because they don't use insurance in the way commercial insurance is understood in this country as a way of financing their systems. They use some kind of tax-based system.
Well, I certainly feel, Dr. Caper, that the single payer should be discussed and the American people should not be insulated against the realities of the rest of the world. After all, right next door in Canada, they have a perfectly workable system. But obviously, there was a political calculus made at the White House not to embrace single payer or even a watered-down version of it, as was described in the public option. And it would seem that they felt that they had to go with an insurance-based system. And it seems that one of the ironies is that while they seem to have been bent over backwards to embrace the insurance companies, to include them, to broaden their pool, apparently a lot of them have been putting money into this attempt to kill Obamacare. So it's the old expression of having them outside the tent as opposed to inside the tent. And it seems, and we recall that that was the fate of Bill Clinton's ill-fated effort too. He invited them in and then they turned around and ran those ads against him. So what's your understanding of the insurance, health insurance industry in general? Can you work with them and can they be placated, or are they basically just too used to having a blank check?
Well, I think you have to understand the nature of the insurance industry in order to answer that question. I'm not one who demonizes the insurance industry. I don't think they're the bad guys. I think they're doing exactly what they are, I think, were created to do. And I'm not talking about the for-profit insurance companies, which have come to dominate the health insurance industry in this country. Their mission, if you want to think of it that way, is to create wealth for their owners. And they're doing a very good job of that. The healthcare system's mission, for example, Medicare, is not really an insurance program. It's largely tax-supported. Its mission is to facilitate medical care for its beneficiaries, the elderly and the chronic renal patients and other disabled other people eligible for Medicare. The health insurance industry's mission, in order to fulfill their mission of maximizing profitability, they actually impede the delivery of medical care by denying claims, by trying to avoid insuring people who are likely to become ill, and so on. So they're performing exactly what they're doing, what they're supposed to be doing. But I think their fundamental mission is in conflict with the mission of a fair and an effective health care system.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Dr. Philip Kaper, who is a doctor in Portland, Maine, and a regular columnist at the Bangor Daily News, where he has a recent article, The High Costs of Complexity in Healthcare Reform. And obviously, again, single payer wasn't on the table, the public option wasn't on the table, and the expansion of Medicare. And you're making a case, obviously, that Medicare, you would think it could have been easily expanded. All they would have had to do to phase it in would be to lower the eligibility age from 65 down to 60 to 55, 50, and so on. Do you have any idea why that wasn't even on the table? Because you've just made a case that it's the most workable system we have, and it could have been the basis of something that's already working and was launched before there were computers, without the kind of glitches that we're having with the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah, well, I think we understand that. I think we have to understand that the American healthcare system, is a very efficient mechanism for transferring wealth and income from people who consume medical services, that is, patients, to people who provide medical services and products. And I think that the expansion of Medicare to everyone, or even as was once proposed during the debate on Obamacare, lowering the eligibility age to 55, or the public option, I mean, those were on the table. They were just simply defeated. It would interfere with that transfer of wealth and income. I think that's the fundamental problem. And the people who are now gaining so much from the healthcare industry, with Stephen Brill, the Time magazine article who wrote that brilliant cover story, Bitter Pill, last March, he calls the healthcare industry an island of affluence within a sea of poverty and misery. And I think the people on that island of affluence would like to keep the money flowing in the direction it's flowing. It's not hard to understand. So they have a lot of money. They have a lot of political power, which they buy with their money. And that's what happened. I think if Senator Kennedy had stayed well enough, long enough, to be an active participant in the development of the Affordable Care Act, I think it would have come out a little differently. We may actually have had a public option.
Well, of course, one of Senator Kennedy's great regrets was that he didn't take up Nixon's offer when Nixon offered up something along the lines of what we're talking about, expanding Medicaid and a sort of national health system. And I think Teddy Kennedy thought he could hold out for something better, but he regretted that he never took up Nixon on it.
Yeah, but I can tell you from firsthand experience, he never stopped thinking that a Medicare program for everyone was the best program. In fact, he introduced legislation in, I think it was 2007, that would have expanded Medicare as an option to everybody, essentially a public option. He and Congressman Dingell introduced that legislation in, I think it was 2000, maybe 2008. So, he always believed that single payer was the best solution. And I guess what I'm trying to say is, I think Obamacare in many ways is a step in the right direction, in the sense that they curbed some of the worst abuses of the insurance industry. They attempted to expand Medicaid to a lot more people. The Supreme Court, of course, ruled that mandatory expansion unconstitutional. But the one thing it does, I think, where it's a move in the wrong direction, is essentially providing billions of dollars in corporate welfare to what was fundamentally a failing commercial insurance industry. And that, bails them out and will give them another perhaps decade or so before they run the string out on this particular model. But I think you're absolutely right. We could have done it much more easily and eliminated much of the complexity. You would have had a 12-page bill instead of a 2,300-page bill. And I think that's at the root of the problems that are showing up as people try to enroll in the Affordable Care Act. Too many moving parts, too many unpredictable, unknown unknowns. And it's really expensive in terms of money. It costs a lot of money to deal with a law that complex. And it's also confused the public. So it's been very difficult to get people to support this law because they don't understand it. I don't understand it, and I've spent hours and hours trying to understand it. So I think there are a number of ways in which the price for this level of complexity has been way too high without really accomplishing much.
But just in terms of, though, you were saying that the insurance companies have, you know, are an island of affluence and that they've been making out like bandits, not your words but mine, and then this is giving them a new lease on life, the Affordable Care Act, but eventually they'll run their string out. Explain that contradiction. If they're doing so well, why are they bound in the long run to fail? Because, you know, right. One of the big arguments about it, and former President Clinton's made this argument on a number of times, is that we spend up to 18% of our GDP on healthcare compared to 6 and 8% in terms of the other advanced democracies. And this, it's the biggest driver of inflation and the biggest driver of the deficit. And we've got to get our hands around this thing. Well, right. It doesn't sound like we are getting our hands around it.
Well, that's just the point. And when I said island of influence, I was referring not only to the insurance companies, but also to the medical device makers, the pharmaceutical companies. You know, we pay far more for brand-name drugs in this country than any other country in the world, sometimes twice as much for exactly the same medication. And the hospitals, you know, even the large non-profit hospital, I mean, Cedars, for example, in Los Angeles is a non-profit hospital, they're doing very, very well. So I'm talking, the island of affluence I was talking about was the entire medical services and products industry. Now, the insurance company's basic business model is to avoid people who get sick and then to resist paying out claims because they don't want to increase what they call their medical loss ratio. I mean, that term itself is quite revealing because they view paying for medical care as a corporate loss, which it is. From their point of view, from a business point of view, it makes perfect sense. What I'm suggesting is that it's the wrong model for a system of financing which is supposed to facilitate medical care, not impede it. And there are only so many times, and so they tend to push anybody who's sick or likely to become sick, who is an individual or has a small business, sooner or later they try to push them off onto the public sector or push them off onto a free care model where the cost of taking care of them has to be picked up by the private sector. It's actually, most people don't understand that it's actually cheaper to insure everybody, to include everybody in the same system, than it is to spend a lot of money trying to figure out who to exclude, which is exactly what we're doing in this country now. So I'm saying it's a failing model because their fundamental mission, which is to maximize profitability, particularly if they're publicly traded, that's an insurance company, is in conflict with the mission of a humane and just healthcare system.
Well, it's certainly, at this point, you know, you have a couple of billionaires, the Koch brothers, encouraging young people not to sign up, calling their front group Generation Opportunity. We know that there's a logic to the bigger the pool, the lower the costs. So just in closing, if the pool, if these the glitches with the website, et cetera, and the complexity that you're talking about, if they drive enough people away, will this thing not work? Because you need as many people signing up in order to make the pool bigger and therefore the costs lower. And if the costs aren't lower, then the public are going to give up on it, aren't they?
Well, not the people who really need insurance, not the people who really need medical care. They won't give up on it. The people who will give up on it, as you point out, are the healthy young people who just will either just pay the fine or figure out there's probably no effective way to enforce the tax penalty, the fine, for not getting insurance. And the program will continue to struggle along for the next several years. I don't expect the Congress to revisit this issue anytime soon for obvious reasons. There's just too much political pain involved in dealing with it, which is why I admire President Obama so much for taking it on, because he knew what he was getting into, although he may not have understood the intensity and the vitriol of the opposition to it. But I think that the advances and the progress is going to be made for a while at the state level. Vermont has already passed legislation creating a path to a single-payer system in Vermont. We're working to try to have the same thing happen here in Maine. The Canadian system started out with one province, Saskatchewan, and it was a very tough fight. They went through a doctor's strike. They went through a lot of political turmoil to get there. But it ended up working so well in Saskatchewan that within 10 years it had become national in Vermont, in Canada, and was nationwide then. I think something similar to that is probably going to happen in this country.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Dr. Philip Caper.
Well, you're welcome. Thanks for calling.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Philip Caper, who is a physician in Portland, Maine, and a regular columnist at the Bangor Daily News, where he has an article, The High Costs of Complexity in Healthcare Reform. And he's also a founding board member of Maine All Care, a nonpartisan, nonprofit group committed to making healthcare in Maine universal, accessible, and affordable for all. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with former Assistant Secretary of Education Diane Ravitch about her new book, Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining me now in the studio is Diane Ravitch, a professor in New York University Steinhardt School of Education and one of America's best-known education experts. She was appointed to the National Assessment Governing Board by President Bill Clinton and served as Assistant Secretary of Education under George H.W. Bush. Through extensive speaking and writing, she established a reputation as a conservative champion of school choice testing standards, No Child Left Behind, and other programs claiming to make schools more efficient and effective. In her book, The Death and Life of the Great American School System, Ravitch explains how she came to make a radical break with those policies. Her most recent book, just out, is Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. Welcome to Background Briefing, Diane Ravitch.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
And we've just learned that 1 in 10 of the recent borrowers defaulted on their federal student loans within the last 2 years, and that's 600,000 borrowers who defaulted last year, and we're talking about the average borrower with federal student debt now carries more than $26,000 in debt, a nearly 43% increase from 2007. What is driving this, do you know?
Well, what's driving it is that, first of all, the cost of higher education continues to grow. States continue to shift the cost to students, and it becomes unbearable for them. There are also many young people who find they just can't, they would rather be working than be in college and accumulating more and more debt that they will have a very difficult time paying off.
Well, apparently we have nearly 40 million, 39 million borrowers carrying more than $1 trillion in federal debt. So that makes student debt now greater than household mortgage debt. Mm-hmm. And my understanding, without getting into the weeds of economics, is that what's happening to our economy here is that these kids and young people that are being burdened with debt, it means that they're not buying houses, they're not buying cars, they're not consuming, and it's having a depressing effect on the overall economy. So who's looking at this in the macro sense?
Well, I don't think that very many people are. I think if you look at a couple of different factors, one is that we've had seen a stupendous growth in the number of for-profit colleges. The for-profit colleges have the biggest default rate of all in terms of their students. They attract young people, particularly minorities and veterans, who think that they can get a fast education and it'll be cheaper. And then they end up dropping out at a higher rate than if they went to a regular college, and they're burdened by debt. So they're a large part of this. When Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa tried to reform the for-profit colleges, this industry, the for-profit college industry, hired lobbyists on both sides of the aisles, Democrats as well, mostly Democrats, but also Republicans, to defend the for-profit industry against regulation. So they continue their predatory practices. I think also another part of this puzzle that we're in has been this claim that everyone has to go to college or there will be failures in life, when in fact the Bureau of Labor Statistics shows that most of the jobs that will be opening up in the next decade don't require a college diploma. Many of the young people who do struggle through college, who do accumulate a huge debt, will find when they get out that there are no jobs for them that are equivalent to the education that they've paid for so dearly, and they'll be selling in an Apple store for minimum wage, or being a barista at Starbucks for maybe a bit more than minimum wage, or taking other jobs that didn't require a college diploma at all.
Well, when you say that the lobbyists weighed in against Tom Harkin, it's worth noting that these lobbyists are spending our dollars.
That's
because
right.
Up to, 80-90% of the revenues to these for-profit colleges comes from directly from Uncle Sam, from government money.
Right. So they're taking public dollars to lobby to protect their private industry. The same thing, which I go into in some depth, is happening in K-12, where we now have a phenomenon of virtual charter schools, which are big cash cows, and they make so much money that they have a lot of money to spend lobbying to expand their reach into more states and into more districts. And they give a very inferior quality of education, and yet they're not regulated because they also make handsome campaign contributions to the right politicians in the state legislatures.
But just in terms of the for-profit college sector, they educate only 13% of students, yet they take in nearly a quarter of the federal money in loans and grants and contribute about 47% of the loan defaults.
Mm-hmm.
So there are the statistics in stock.
Well, that's a pretty stark number, that
right.
Such a small number of colleges are causing so much of the debt. And these young people
and
will
default
spend—
default on the debt.
And default on the debt. And these young people will spend years burdened by the debt that they can't repay. So we're actually doing harm to them. And yet I can't recall the New York Times article that gave the names of the lobbyists. Many of them were very prominent Democratic politicians who made their reputations as progressives, and they're now being paid to defend the for-profit sector in higher education, which is a terrible scandal.
Well, my understanding is that the head of the Washington Post, Graham, went to the White House, mm-hmm. met with Cass Sunstein and the others, and weighed in on behalf, because he owns the real profit center for the Washington Post, which was recently sold to Amazon, was this Kaplan division
yes.
that they have. So in order to protect Kaplan and the rest of the for-profits, he apparently personally, because he has some clout as a publisher of the Washington Post, went to the White House and weighed in. Also, my understanding is that Susan Collins left the Senate because her husband was involved in
yes.
one of these shady for-profit colleges.
And yes, John, who was John McKiernan.
Yeah, and he's under investigation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So who's pushing back? You've got the lobbyists on the one side really aiding and abetting criminality in the sense that, you know, we know that this is federal money that's recycled to these people. They charge it back to these kids at exorbitant rates. They give them a worthless diploma and indenture them for life with debt. So who's pushing back?
Well, who's pushing back? What's sad is it's not the Obama administration, because they've been compromised by having so many of lobbyists that came either through their administration or through the Democratic leadership saying you can't regulate us. And the same, you mentioned the Washington Post. The Washington Post has a lot of clout in D.C., and they were a failing newspaper. buoyed by Kaplan University and also by the Kaplan test prep. So the newspaper was unfortunately, I guess you'd say, compromised because its revenue stream depended on these for-profit industries and not on the newspaper, which is why they ultimately sold to Jeff Bezos. The question is going for me is, will Jeff Bezos continue to shelter the for-profit higher education sector and also the testing industry? Will he see this as part of his revenue stream? He certainly doesn't need to. He's already a billionaire.
I don't think they sold that Kaplan to him, did they?
Who kept Kaplan?
I think the Washington Post Company did. I mean, the Graham family did.
Well, then you know more than I do. The Graham family kept it.
That's my recollection of the deal. I may be wrong.
I don't know. I assumed when he bought the Washington Post, he bought the package, which would have included Kaplan University.
Right.
I mean, all of this, the whole Kaplan University, all of this stems from a little test prep business that a guy named Stanley Kaplan invented in Brooklyn.
Right. Again, I'm speaking with Diane Ravitch, a professor at the New York University Steinhardt School of Education and one of America's best-known education experts. She served as Assistant Secretary of Education under George H.W. Bush, and her latest book just out is Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. Now, here in Los Angeles, of course, we have the billionaire Eli Broad. You've also got up in Washington State the billionaire Bill Gates.
In Arkansas, they have the billionaire Walton family, of whom there are many billionaires.
The Walton family alone, the heirs, own the wealth equivalent to the lower 40% of all Americans. Mm-hmm. And what are they doing with their money?
Well, the Walton family, the Broad Foundation, the Gates Foundation, are all intent on promoting charter schools, which I argue in the book is a form of privatization because it's handing public money over to private corporations, which is privatization. Gates is not as conservative as Walton. He has also put a lot of money into this idea that you can evaluate teachers by using the test scores of their students. And in my book, I demonstrate that this is a completely invalid idea. It produces results that are simply not credible. That's not the way to evaluate teacher quality. And I could go on and on why that's a bad idea. And Gates himself, I think, has begun to get the news because he said just the other day that we won't know for a decade whether this stuff works. That's exactly the way he put it, this stuff that he's poured hundreds of millions of dollars into, where he's persuaded the U.S. Department of Education. I don't think he had to work very hard to persuade them. They seem to follow whatever his lead is. But the U.S. Department of Education has now foisted or imposed or prodded almost every state into evaluating teachers by the test scores of their students, despite the fact that researchers say this is wrong. It doesn't work. It many excellent teachers will be fired, and many mediocre teachers will get a bonus, and that's the way it works. But many people are being fired based on something that Bill Gates had a hunch about. So that's how he's using his money, both for charters and also teacher evaluation. The Broad Foundation has something that it calls the Broad Superintendents Academy, and it's uncertified, unaccredited, and they teach management ideas. The big management idea seems to be that if a public school has low test scores, you close it and open something else, either a charter school or another public school. But the theory is that schools are like shoe stores or hot dog stands, and if it doesn't make a profit, close it and start over.
So how much of this is the thrall of politicians with billionaires? I mean, Bill Clinton, you know, obviously was influenced by a lot of his friends on Wall Street, Rubin and all those characters, which led to him pushing for the deregulation and getting rid of Glass-Steagall, and we know what the consequences were with the 2008 crash. And it seems that the current incumbent in the White House is somewhat enthralled by billionaires and captains of industry.
You understand that the lifeblood of politics is money. And so it's not simply a matter of being enthralled, although almost everyone seems to be enthralled to Bill Gates. They're so blown away by the idea that this man is worth so many billions of dollars that it reminds me of that song from Fiddler on the Roof, if he's rich, he really must know. So everybody kind of bows and scrapes before him, and I'm afraid that whereas he may be a well-intentioned man, and I don't think he's in it for the money. He doesn't need any more money. But I think he doesn't have anyone on his staff who ever says to him, this is a bad idea, don't do it. So he has a hunch. He goes around the country saying, our public schools are failing, our public schools are obsolete. He's dead wrong. Our public schools are not failing. Our public schools actually have the highest test scores they've ever had in history, the lowest dropout rate we've ever had in history, the highest graduation rates we've ever had in history. He's wrong. And where we do have a crisis is in our inner cities where there is high poverty and high segregation. I note that Los Angeles, for example, is the poorest school district in the entire state of California. California has an outrageous level of poverty, and this coexists with some of the richest people in the country, where some folks go out for dinner and they spend $500 on a bottle of wine and think nothing of it, where other people, many, many more people, aren't sure that they will have a meal on their table at night. And this is the scandal. The great scandal is that instead of us talking about a tax structure that allows some people to be multi-billionaires, and others to live in dire poverty, we're not talking about that. We're talking about school reform.
And why do you think then, I've seen 60 Minutes do, you know, laudatory segments on these charter schools, inner city charter schools. Is it the sort of white man's burden idea?
Well, I think
patronizing
that,
kind of.
What we've seen about charter schools is a very well-versed, well-thought-out PR campaign. And the PR campaign is charter schools are better than public schools, and if you ever hope to send your child to college, you must get into a charter school because they're so great. The reality is that most studies agree that charter schools are no better than public schools if they have the same students. But unfortunately, the difference between charter schools and public schools is that charter schools are allowed to choose the kids. So most of them choose not to have students with disabilities. If they have extreme disabilities, they never take them. If they choose not to have very many English learners, so that they exclude the kids who are likely to drag their test scores down. If the kids have behavior problems, they'll be held back, they'll be pushed out, or they'll be counseled out. So then the public schools, in effect, become a dumping ground, while the charter schools are allowed to pick and choose and continue to grow and to make ridiculous claims because they're not better than public schools.
Well, you've just told us that the test scores are higher than ever in public schools.
Yes.
Public schools are not failing, and yet that is the common mantra.
And this is because, as I try to explain in the book, I used to think that the testing movement was one thing and the privatization movement was another. But I came to realize in the course of writing this book that they're actually part of the same narrative. It begins like this: our schools are failing, therefore escape if you can, and we must save whoever we can save. And that's why we have to have charter schools, that's why we have to have vouchers, that's why we have to have any possible alternative. Kids have to get out. It's all a lie. It's like all a great hoax, and that's the reason the subtitle of the book is The Hoax of the Privatization Movement. The hoax is built on a narrative that's false. And if people understood that our public schools are actually doing a better job than ever, that they are overwhelmed in many cases by the numbers of kids who live in poverty and who come to school hungry and homeless and never having had medical care for the problems they have, we would have a different set of policies. We wouldn't be offering private alternatives to public schools. We would be offering the services that the children actually need.
Again, I'm speaking with Diane Ravitch, professor in the New York University Steinhardt School of Education, one of America's best-known education experts, and the author of the new book just out, Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. And in terms of this hoax and the lies about testing, surely people remember what happened recently down in Georgia, where a school superintendent and I think a whole bunch of other teachers would meet regularly and have parties and alter the scores of the kids and fix their, you know, test papers, erase errors and write over them and make them all look like they're a bunch of geniuses. And this school, of course, won all kinds of awards. She herself won some huge award, you know, Superintendent of the Year or something, mm-hmm. Got a big chunk of money. And it turned out that eventually they were busted. But the cruel part of it is all these kids who have artificially high scores, what happens to them?
Well, it actually isn't just limited to Atlanta. It's happening in many places. When you put high incentives on test scores and high punishments on test scores, some people do desperate things. They want to keep their job. They have a mortgage to pay. They need the money, and they cheat, and it's wrong, and they should be indicted. They should be punished. As it happens, it extends way beyond Atlanta. The superintendent of schools in El Paso was recently convicted of having gamed the system. He was kicking kids out who might get low test scores before the tests so that El Paso would appear to have higher test scores. There have been reports of cheating in many cities and in many districts. But I think what's behind all of this is the belief on the part of these corporate types that test scores are somehow the end product or the measure, both the measure and the end product, that this is what we have to aim for, that a great education, we're racing to the top. That's the signature program of the Obama administration. We must race to the top to get higher test scores. What I understand is people in the testing business do is that the test is not really that great a measure. In fact, the tests are deeply flawed. I spent 7 years on the National Assessment Governing Board. That's the agency that oversees the federal testing program. I saw many test questions that had two right answers, arguably. I saw questions where I didn't think any of the answers were correct. I saw items on the test where the question itself was wrong or confusing. And I know that when students are giving written answers rather than just picking a bubble, the people scoring these tests are not educators. They're typically $11 an hour workers, temps, culled from Craigslist. And yet they're being paid by how quickly they can score these written answers. They're given a rubric. This is a right answer. This is a wrong answer. The testing industry is pushing this testing. And what few Americans know, even people in the academic world don't realize, we're the only country in the world that tests every child every year. And we're not getting much for it because even if the test scores go up, they're going up because of coaching, test prep. We're stealing time from instruction. There are schools that are eliminating the arts programs, cutting back on physical education, doing things that make school less attractive to kids because the test scores are so important that the whole school year becomes focused on getting those test scores. And this is not good schooling and it's not good education.
Well, Diane Ravitch, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Diane Ravitch, a professor in New York University's Steinhardt School of Education and one of America's best-known education experts. She was appointed to the National Assessment Governing Board by President Bill Clinton and served as Assistant Secretary of Education under George H.W. Bush. Through extensive speaking and writing, she established a reputation as a conservative champion of school choice testing standards, No Child Left Behind, and other programs claiming to make schools more efficient and effective. In her book, The Death and Life of the Great American School System, Ravitch explains how she came to make a radical break with those policies. Her most recent book just out is Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.